Hello and welcome to the D2C podcast. I'm Eric Dick. Today, we're in an absolute bulking phase with Dan McCormick, founder of Create, a creatine gummy brand that Dan's built in public over the past year, driving it to $4 million in sales in his first year of operation. This podcast breaks down the market strategy, the form factor, and the growth marketing plan that's allowed him to scale so quickly, almost like he's on some kind of supplementation. Stay tuned for Dan's warm takes on the CPC December debacle, as well as what he thinks Twitter's biggest problem is. Hint, it's not Disney, it's that their algorithm sucks. Along with tons of great insights, this podcast demystifies one of the most popular and widely taken supplements in the world, creatine. And much like this podcast, it supplies energy to your muscles and may also promote brain health. In fact, I'm taking it myself, can't you tell? You ready to get pumped up? On with the show.
Where the major LTV wins often are made are within like the first 30 days of a customer. When you just start from a much higher AOV on the first order, it makes everything much, much easier. It's like, how can you start out with an LTV advantage on day one by having high first order AOV? There's going to be a certain percentage of customers that always buy the largest quantity, lowest cost per unit offering. We'll sell you a bag of creatine each month on subscription, but we'll also sell you a 3-month supply all at once. And hell, at some point, I'm sure we'll roll out 12 bags of creatine all at once for a major discount and try to get that AOV on that first order as high as possible. That extreme behavior will pull up the averages.
If you're a D2C brand on Shopify and you're not using Black Crow, then you're leaving significant revenue on the table. Black Crow uses your own data to help you identify customers returning to your site who would otherwise remain anonymous. The more customers you can identify, the more email and SMS abandonment messages you can send. You'll see incremental revenue almost immediately without having to change any of your existing flows. The best part? All it takes is a one-click integration. There's zero development work required. Head on over to blackcrow.ai/DTC to get started with a free 30-day trial. Dan, welcome to the D2C podcast. This is a long time coming. Super happy to have you here. Tell us a little bit about your background that brought you to build Create.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Eric. So I've been in e-commerce now for the majority of my career. I graduated college back in 2017. Lucky enough to get my first job essentially at a company called Away, which popularized the Rolly suitcase, at one point a battery powered suitcase that was killed by the FAA recently. But basically entered that company as the lowest man on the totem pole. I don't know if you've seen an Away suitcase, but back in the day you could get them monogrammed, and my first job was essentially managing the operations of our monogramming studio. Had the opportunity to work there for a bunch of years, learn the ropes of D2C. This was 2017, a kind of amazing time to enter the industry. At the time, the companies were raising a lot of money, attracting a lot of top talent. And so it was a really great place to learn kind of retailing and D2C more specifically. After that, had the opportunity to join a company called Parade, a women's basic, women's underwear company, as the head of finance, kind of first business person there. That company grew from, call it sub, 1 million when I joined, all the way up to around 30 million top line about 18 months later when I left. And again, just kind of had the opportunity to learn a ton for basically like a 25-year-old de facto CFO, and learn the ins and outs of the business. Was not the founder of that company, but in many ways operated the business side of things during my tenure. And then after a couple of years, I decided, kind of looking at the value chain in D2C and like how to make an impact, how to build wealth within D2C. It turns out you kind of have to start one of these brands. And had always kind of had the entrepreneurial spirit and knowledge that I want to go out and start something, just didn't really have exactly what that idea was when I left Parade. Had the opportunity to go work with my brother, Packy McCormick, who runs a media and venture business, supporting him, writing, selling ads, building out the business side of what he's doing, supporting portfolio companies. And the understanding there was, hey, Dan, help me kind of formalize what I'm doing here. And when the time is right, you can go off and start your own thing. And I think that time just came a lot sooner than either of us expected. So about a month into starting to work with him, came up with the idea for Create, And the idea for Create was, let's start the first modern creatine brand. Creatine's a supplement that's been around for over 30 years. It's the most studied fitness supplement on the market. People that take their health and wellness the most seriously basically consider it a table stakes supplement. But like 99% of the population basically thought it was a dangerous steroid only meant for a very small percentage of the population. And so taking all those learnings from, you know, the career in D2C, the narrative building with Packy, I was like, oh, this is a great opportunity to apply the playbook that I learned, apply kind of the online marketing skills that I learned from working with Pack and popularize and modernize a supplement that I thought was widely underpenetrated. And not only was it a good business opportunity, but a pretty core belief here is that, I think everyone would be better off and the country would be much better off if we were taking our health and wellness more seriously, if we were engaging in strength building activities more consistently. And thing about creatine is if you take it consistently with strength and conditioning and resistance training, you're going to get somewhere between, call it 5 to 15% stronger. And so that's a great first order effect. But think of all the second and third order effects if you're able to onboard, you know, millions, tens of millions of people to a supplement that gets them 5 to 15% stronger. So that's my kind of long-winded background.
That's awesome. I'm doing it right now. I'm on creatine. My second BioSteel of the day has creatine mixed into it, but the form factor isn't the best. It's sort of, it makes it have a bit of a syrupy taste a little bit. So you've also updated that with your product, having it be a gummy, which is something I don't see as much of. And you're able to get the full, what is it like? I forget what the recommended dose is, but you're able to get the full recommended dose in one or two gummies only.
Yeah, so the recommended dosage is 3 to 5 grams. Honestly, that's just the recommended dosage because that's what most of the research on creatine is on, is 3 to 5 grams. I think unlike other compounds, the dosing is actually not super precise. Call it, you know, 3 probably minimum, but all the way up to 10 grams a day, and you're going to see benefits. So the form factor is important for a couple of reasons, and we got a ton of flack from people that have taken creatine forever on this. It's like, oh, this is just a marked up creatine product. What's the value of a gummy? Why am I paying more? And the reason people are paying more is essentially convenience, and convenience leads to compliance, and compliance leads to better results, right? So I always say when people are like, why not just take a powder? Well, if you're able to consistently take a powder 5 to 7 times a week, and it's something you enjoy doing, more power to you, right? Like that's awesome. It's cheaper. Potentially it's already part of your routine. Like, stick with it. But for the vast majority of people, one, they're not consistently doing most things in their lives 5 to 7 times a week. Two, for creatine to work, to actually see the benefits, it's not an acute compound in the sense that you take it, you start to feel your skin itch when you go to the gym. It's not like a stimulant. It's the benefits are cumulative over time. So you really need to be taking it 5 to 7 days a week. And the benefit of the gummy is it's actually something that people look forward to taking. And because they look forward to taking it, because it's a little treat each morning or each evening, they actually do it. And so it tastes better, right? It's not that creatine powder tastes terrible, but the gummy does taste better. And two, it's just more convenient and easier to kind of build into your routine.
Love it. And so you're very strategic about picking, an area that needed to be revitalizing, changing the form factor of it. It's something imminently shippable, probably a good margin product as well. Did a great job with the brand. Describe your go-to, like with all your experience in D2C, describe your go-to-market strategy when you initially launched it.
Yeah, so I started this business kind of, I thought it was a good opportunity for two reasons. One, you know, it's a compound that I've taken for a decade. As I discussed earlier, I think there are many both first and second and third order effects of getting more people onboarded onto creatine. I think it's a great mission. But secondarily, I think it's like, if I were to kind of construct a perfect modern physical product brand today, this product kind of fits into it, right? So as you mentioned, it's structurally high margin. Two, it's a consumable that you're taking every day. So it lends itself very well to a subscription product, and if not a subscription product, a high repeat purchase product. Three, you can build a really strong kind of D2C online business, standalone e-commerce business on it. But there's all these other channels that already have kind of established creatine distribution pockets within it. So Amazon's a huge retailer of creatine products. You have these specialty supplement stores that are already selling millions to tens of millions or hundreds of millions of grams of creatine a year. But then you look into grocery and big box, and there's really not a gram of creatine being sold. Like if you walk into a Whole Foods today, there's entire supplement categories. It seems like 10 to 15% of the footprint is basically dedicated to selling collagen, yet there's not 1 gram of creatine in the store. So there's that kind of big untapped omni-channel opportunity. And then the final thing that I thought kind of lends itself well to D2C is that creatine is something that people either love or hate, right? So people that take creatine and have had positive experiences with it generally love talking about creatine. I think it kind of goes back to like, think about CrossFit, right? People that do CrossFit love talking about CrossFit.
Creatine, and now we all know about CrossFit.
And now we all know about CrossFit, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And I don't think, it's not lost to me that there's definitely strong overlap between the CrossFit community and the creatine community. But I think it's one of those things that like, because the benefits are real, because it's not another one of these supplements that don't actually have real or supportive benefits, people enjoy talking about it. There's tons of education you can do around creatine. And at the same time, this wide swath of people also believe that it's like a steroid and they like want to tell you how bad this is for you and how you shouldn't be taking it and all the things that lead to kind of a controversial compound. Creatine has those characteristics. So just like kind of a passionate both pro and con community behind it that allows for, you know, good debate and kind of good discourse around the company and what we're trying to do.
You had a doctor recently tell you or question your creatine intake. You had to sort of educate your doctor.
Yeah, I had my checkup, and I don't get my checkup as often as I do, so I can't really call it an annual checkup, but I had my call it 5-year annual checkup a couple of weeks ago. My doctor is asking me about my diet and different lifestyle choices, and she gets to supplements, and I tell her I take creatine. She's like, oh, are you a bodybuilder? She can see that now I'm sitting there in my skivvies. I'm not a bodybuilder. And so she, you know, was questioning why I'm doing this, educating me that it's unhealthy, it's going to destroy my kidneys. I should really do more research. I don't really say anything much. I'm like, oh, cool. That's not kind of what I've learned about it. That's not what I believe. And then fast forward 5 minutes, she's going through the other lifestyle questions. So what do you do for a living? Oh, I actually sell creatine. So that led to some passionate kind of spirited conversation thereafter, all in good jest. But
which you spoke about, right? Like that's literally what it is. You want something that people have a take on one way or the other. And I find that whether it's your brand or your product, you want it, having people make a decision about it is not a bad thing because at least they're thinking about it.
And I don't blame this kind of general physician for not being fully up to date on creatine literature, right? Like she probably had one class dedicated to nutrition in med school, let alone supplements, let alone creatine, a specific supplement during med school. So that's one of the things we're fighting against. Like there's this whole kind of ecosystem of medical information that doesn't necessarily align with current best practices today. And, you know, I think creatine and other compounds are slowly starting to become more popularized and understood by the medical community, but it's just, it doesn't have kind of the staying power that other lifestyle choices or medical medicines and doesn't have the whole infrastructure around it that a more regulated industry would.
There's just room to grow, and it's not bad to have that, not enemy, but that opposing force in a way, right? Like that can be part of your identity or part of, you know, this education mission about what creatine can be. But I wanted to ask more specifically when it comes to, you mentioned all the different available distribution channels, but when it comes to growing creatine, which you've been really public about on Twitter, what have been the driving forces to actually get gummies to lips?
Yeah. So from an acquisition perspective, Meta is our main channel. We deploy, I would say, over 80-85% of our acquisition spend on Meta. I think the thing about Meta is that it's always more expensive today than it was yesterday. That statement holds true. And like Meta is probably the most efficient that it ever will be today. And so continuing to invest in that platform now rather than kind of waiting for opportunities down the line, I think has always been the smart choice in Meta. I think, you know, going back to kind of Meta in general, it's like the greatest customer acquisition product tool man has ever known. Like, you look at Google. Yep. Google is not great at generating demand, right? It's great at kind of imposing attacks on demand you've created elsewhere. But Meta is one of the few scalable channels specifically available to small, medium-sized businesses like Create, where you can generate significant demand with relative ease and predictability. And so, yeah, that's a channel we take very seriously, and it's kind of guiding the business. But beyond that, you know, we're I guess, lucky to have a really strong repeat business. And repeat is both subscription and non-sub repeat customers. And that allows us to aggressively invest in whatever acquisition channel it is that we're investing in.
Specifically with Meta, what's the approach that's working best? Is it? I've heard some people say UGC is dead, which I know not to be the case. But I'm curious, what forms of creative? How are you utilizing Meta to its fullest extent?
Yeah, we do a lot of UGC. We do a lot of directed UGC. What played well during Black Friday, Cyber Monday was just like, and I saw this across a bunch of different brands that I follow, just very simple statics, cleanly stating the deal. And I think it just goes back to like, knowing what your customer wants when. And during Black Friday, Cyber Monday, people aren't looking for education. People are looking for deals. Other times of the year, they may be looking less for deals and may be looking more to get kind of onboarded into a new daily routine. And so putting out ads and content like that may be more beneficial. I think it's like the breadth of creative, I think, is kind of where you find your winners. I don't necessarily have a strong perspective as to exactly what that creative looks like.
What about on metrics? What's your perspective on CPC? Were you following a little bit this weekend?
Yeah.
The absolute D2C Twitter blow up about, and I think it's funny. I've looked at your Twitter feed and you've got some interesting ideological takes on other things. And I feel like you just tweeted a little bit about how people kind of mess up by polarizing on issues and kind of misunderstanding the core in some cases. You reposted something by your brother Packy. And I feel like that's what happened this weekend with the CPC debate. Is like both parties were saying reasonable things, but they were kind of calling each other clowns in ways that sort of like made the other the enemy. What's your take on CPC as whether or not it's a valuable metric?
Yeah, I don't have a take. I'm not a sophisticated media buyer, and I think the more sophisticated that I was, I would probably have even less of a take on it. I think it all comes back to, especially on Twitter with this stuff and the discourse around it, it's all, everyone has incentives, right? A lot of those guys have agencies that those agencies rely on kind of measuring by CPC, and a lot of those guys have agencies that say, hey, just value us on our CPAs, right? I think, like, I kind of agree with Stuck on the sense that, like, if your CPCs are looking pretty good, that's probably generally indicative if everything else is in line with, like, as long as you're not running cheap traffic campaigns, if you're running conversion-optimized campaigns and your CPCs look pretty good and your CRO is in a good place, that's probably going to lend well to pretty good CPAs as well. And I also agree with, who is it, Barry was the other side of it.
Yeah.
That, like, at the end of the day, I don't give a shit what my CPCs are as long as my CPAs are pretty good. And so, yeah, I see both sides. And I think, like, you know, everyone, I think by their own admission, are kind of doing it for the clicks. So,
yeah, it's just fun to have a scene, you know, it's fun to get caught up in that stuff a little bit. You mentioned AOV and repeat purchase value. So what are the things that you've done that have been the best for encouraging, I guess, AOV and LTV?
Yeah. So on the AOV front specifically, and I think you'll see this around, like, a lot of brands talk about this, like, where the major LTV wins often are made are within, like, the first 30 days of a customer, right? It's like, how can you get, when you just start from a much higher AOV on the first order, it makes everything much, much easier. And so those two questions are kind of one and the same for us. It's like, how can you start out with an LTV advantage on day one by having a high first order AOV? And for us, we just have kind of come to the conclusion that, like, there's going to be a certain percentage of customers that always buy the largest quantity, lowest cost per unit offering that the website has to offer, right? So for us, it's like, our main thing is we'll sell you a bag of creatine each month on subscription, but we'll also sell you, you know, a 3-month supply all at once. And how, you know, at some point, I'm sure we'll roll out, buy all 12 bags of creatine all at once for a major discount and try to get that AOV on that first order as high as possible, knowing that that's not going to be, you know, the most frequent purchasing behavior, but there'll be a certain percentage of customers that make that decision, and that extreme behavior will pull up the averages. And so, yeah, that's kind of the major learning there is, like, how can we get first order AOV up? It also is helpful because buying in large quantity, buying in bulk, generally scales pretty well for our type of product where shipping doesn't scale linearly with AOV. And
it's totally non-perishable as well, as opposed to some other CPG type products that you actually have that negative effect of like, oh, I'm getting stuff that I can't use. And then, you know, you don't really have that where you just store it in a cupboard. It's just part of your ritual. It's like a commitment to your fitness.
We have like a, you know, 18-month expiration on our product. So yes.
Okay.
But relative to selling you, I don't know, some kind of more perishable CPG good. Yes. It's, it's like a pretty long shelf life. I think the other big thing is that like subscription, like I think most of these businesses ultimately will be valued in a perfect kind of valuation world, not during a peak frenzy or a kind of trough that we've been in the last 2 years. Most of these consumable businesses, at least from an e-commerce perspective, should be measured more on their reoccurring subscription revenue versus any kind of major peaks of like one-time revenue. That's obviously a big focus for us as well and lends well to LTV performance.
How was your Black Friday, Cyber Monday?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was decent. It was our first one kind of. So like, I think looking back, there's definitely some things we left on the table. I think transparently, we did like 150K over that 4-day period from Friday to Monday. And that's like maybe 2X what that would be on a normal weekend when things are firing in the right direction. So definitely good and welcome from a cash flow and performance perspective, but not like the whole business is kind of betting on that 4 days of performance for us. We actually, because we're supplements, because we're like health and wellness, the end of December, beginning of January is likely going to be a higher intent, higher volume time for us than Black Friday or Cyber Monday.
You did yourself a favor prior by launching a new flavor as well, right? Everyone's favorite Blue Raz.
Blue Raz, yeah. I was actually talking to probably the top sports nutrition supplements buyer in the country just by function of his title and where he works. And he said the number one flavor at their major supplements chain is Blue Raz across a variety of different flavors. That's not something I actually knew going into it. I just knew I personally like Blue Raz. And I also thought, and I can tell you like it as well, I like that kind of bluish rural blue color from a marketing perspective. So it all kind of lined up perfectly.
And it's one of those, I mentioned this to you on Twitter. I learned it through another podcast that it helps to flavor things like things that don't actually exist in nature, because then people are like, oh, this doesn't taste like a cinnamon bun, or this doesn't, it's like, who really knows what, no one's actually eaten a blue raspberry. So we all know it just tastes like the icy or, you know, the Slurpee or whatever that we had as a kid that stuck with us so much.
Totally. It's, people are still comping to those products, but not in the same way that they're comping an orange creatine gummy to they're like an actual slice of orange, which is much more one-to-one with Blue Raz. It like just kind of has to be in that general vicinity of blue raspberry-ness versus like, hey, this tastes like an orange.
Sorry, one sec. Just scrolling through my inbox right now and reading some banger texts like this recipe from Graza, this sale reminder from Brooklyn, and oh yeah, this gift guide from Dr. Squatch. What do all these brands have in common? They all use PostScript for their SMS marketing. PostScript is on a mission to make SMS the number one revenue channel for e-commerce merchants by delivering an easy-to-use platform where they can grow their subscriber list, develop and test their messaging strategy, deliver excellent customer service, and drive sales and loyalty all in one place. Over 12,000 merchants are using PostScript in their tech stack, and you should too. Visit postscript.io/DTC to receive an exclusive offer. I want to get it. It's when we did our event in Las Vegas, we had Nick Saltarelli, and he did a lot of talking about his business is finances, basically. And this is something you tweeted about recently in a big, you're sort of doing like quarterly updates on Twitter, which I think everyone should be following you for. They're super, super interesting. You mentioned EBITDA, and you mentioned a little bit just about the business's underlying finances. Can you talk to, because I guess you have this background kind of working as a, you know, de facto CFO. I'm just interested, how do you think of this business's finances? And also I think you're also one of those businesses that has like pretty low staff overhead, right? Like you're a pretty lean team. Is that right?
Yeah.
It's how lean?
Full-time is just me right now. If it got any more lean, it would be pretty bad for my own, I guess, health. I think a lot of these businesses, like, obviously you need a really great product, and product like kind of makes everything else a lot easier. But D2C businesses are really a function of marketing and kind of finance. I guess you could kind of say that about any business, but it's just, I guess, how I kind of break it down for myself. The time of parade was super helpful to kind of operate a scaling D2C business from a financial perspective. But I think even less so like traditional finance, just having a kind of quantitative approach, data-driven approach to making decisions, whether they be pricing, whether they be budgeting, whether they be LTV analysis, that kind of data-driven approach actually started at Away. I think Away is one of those businesses that's gotten a lot of flack in the last couple of years, partially because staff had a tough exit, partially because the pandemic definitely hurt their business, partially because there's now like 3 to 4 pretty notable copycat products out in the market, whether it's Monos or Base or whoever it may be. But like they kind of accumulated a ton of really top-notch talent specifically within finance and data and analytics and growth marketing at the time. And so that's kind of where I learned the ropes.
You mentioned Amazon as an area for growth. What are you guys, are you doing much on Amazon right now?
Yeah, so we're doing some like basic marketing on Amazon, trying to set like, so I guess some context there. When we launched on Amazon, I believe we were the first creatine monohydrate gummy on the platform. And so when we launched, we basically went from like 0 to 5,000 within a week with little marketing support. In the intermittent months, kind of two things have happened. One, our first summer of selling gummies, we learned the hard way that gummies can get a little melty in the summer. And that crushed our Amazon listing for a period of time before we were able to reformulate the product and get kind of like an anti-melt formulation to market. And so we basically had to kill our old listing, launch a new listing with the new product. The second thing was that basically every co-manufacturer in the gummy and supplements world started making knockoff creatine gummies. And so Amazon was flooded with a bunch of low quality options. And so now it's just a little bit more competitive. I think we're still the top volume gummy and kind of only at scale creatine gummy on Amazon. But we're definitely not doing anything to reinvent the wheel. What I've kind of come to learn at this point, going back to demand generation, until you hit like a certain level of, Amazon's success for us right now basically relies on Meta success. Basically, we can expect a third of basically every dollar we put into Meta to translate into like $1 on Amazon. So if we spend $3,000 of spend on Meta, that basically translates pretty correlatively to $1,000 of revenue on Amazon. And so a lot of the success we're seeing there is actually more a function of what we're doing off platform. But on platform, you know, we're focusing on trying to get our reviews really tight. We're making sure that right now we're rolling out like branded pages and doing a bunch of the like more sophisticated page building and marketing schemas that you can do with Amazon once you hit a certain level of scale. At this point, it's like really a demand capture for demand we're generating off Amazon.
Makes sense. Q4, you roughly doubled over Black Friday, Cyber Monday, your regular pace, which congratulations on that. And then we're headed into whatever Q5, but also like new year, new you. And I imagine there's going to be, during this period, a lot of advertisers will be kind of like throttling their spend a little bit. So do you have plans to be more aggressive given the seasonality of your product, like in the next little while?
Yeah, definitely. So I think in November, we grew top line like 21%, but spend was actually down, call it like 25%. And part of that was One, we didn't necessarily see a great opportunity to increase spend from an acquisition perspective during November because everyone is advertising during that period. But two, knowing kind of the dynamics you just laid out there, that a lot of the acquisition-focused brands exit around December 22nd and don't re-enter until kind of like Valentine's Day. Whereas, so there's basically this dynamic of less competition in the auction and our customers specifically having higher intent during that period because, to your point, New Year, New You, New Year's resolutions, gifting yourself, all these different kind of dynamics around January 1st, where people take their health and wellness a little bit more seriously. So those two things of like more efficient auction for us and then higher customer intent during that period. Yeah, so we saved up money essentially to deploy then.
If we were going to give you a $50,000 grant, is that what you do? Would you just put it right into acquisition on Meta right now? Or is there anything else you'd do with an additional funds that you were given?
$50,000?
I know it's not crazy, just 50.
Yeah, I'd put that. I'd say, okay, for the course of December, let's raise our budgets by $1,200 a day.
What if it was $100,000? Would you just, is there a threshold in which you'd like use some of it for another kind of moonshot? Or is right now Meta just such a strong engine that you just keep pumping into it?
I think some of the larger kind of business, like step change type of things that I would do would take more than $100,000. So an example here, and just by the function of me saying this means we're probably not going to do it anytime soon. Like a Tim Ferriss or an Andrew Huberman or a Joe Rogan campaign on their podcasts. I think that's kind of where a lot of these supplement brands see like, oh, they're growing really linearly and nicely, but then they've hit a certain level of scale where they can afford to make those types of bets. And those guys aren't doing like, yeah, we'll give you a one-time $5,000 remnant spot on our podcast. No, it's like we have, you know, exclusivity with you for the next 2 years and you're going to pay us X amount of dollars every, like it's a big investment. And so I think at some point maybe we'll hit that scale. But
not for the chump change I'm offering. I get it. Have you seen the clips? It's just one clip I see going around from the show on Netflix called Fall of the House of Usher. And it's literally Bruce Greenwood, one of my favorite actors. And he's explaining what he would do. He's like, when life gives you lemons, you and the other guy goes, make lemonade. And he goes, no, first of all, you start a multi-year campaign to make everyone think lemons are scarce. And then he describes like the high level, like propaganda techniques he would use. And I'm just interested if there's a level at which like creatine, there's a bit of an information war about creatine that we've described. So it'd be interesting to think about ways that you can, or that companies like yours can find ways to put creatine into that broader ideological conversation.
Yeah. I mean, totally. That's kind of how I view this a little bit. Like one, there's the more call performance marketing side of things like Meta, where, you know, you're kind of investing $1 and getting 1.25 back, hopefully on a good day. And then there's kind of the more brand marketing, or I think the term you might use is like propagandizing of creatine generally, or more specifically of Create as a brand. I think like largely when you look at something like greens, for example, like AG1 has done a really good job of helping establish the category, but like they needed a ton of help from people that were looking for a topic like greens to talk about on a daily basis, just from a content perspective. And so there's like, you know, we didn't start the conversation around creatine. We are not the people that, you know, saw creatine Google search trends go from like this for the last 10 years to this. Like that wasn't us. That was people like Huberman, Atiyah, Lane Norton, Rhonda Patrick, all kind of these major health and wellness influencers that for whatever reason, in the last 18 months or so, have decided to focus a lot of their content on creatine. We've been a beneficiary of that. And I think kind of as the business scales, we'll become less of a pure taker and beneficiary of that and hopefully contribute to part of that growth story.
Very cool. What's part of your tech stack that you couldn't live without, especially as a one-man shop? I know you have contractors as well, but like what's a part of your tech stack that you couldn't live without?
Yeah, I mean, I'm addicted to Triple Whale. And that's not to say I don't have a dog in that fight, Triple Whale versus North Beam versus whoever other analytics or dashboard players are. That's what we use for whatever reason. And so I'm checking that 25 times a day, much to the chagrin of my partner. What else? I like Superfiliate. They're a relatively new kind of affiliate and referral platform. Make it really easy to onboard affiliates, get them set up with custom landing pages, unique links and codes, and having them kind of customize the experience for the end customer. This tool, Nostra, that I don't know if you've heard of them. I don't know how I came across them. They're like a site speed software that actually isn't complete bullshit. I feel like every site speed agency or freelancer or software tool that I've come across in the past is like pretty much fugazi and doesn't actually like, they all throw that, you know, 1 millisecond of speed translates to like a 3% increase in conversion or whatever bullshit Amazon metric that is. They all throw that in your face and try to get you to pay them $10,000 a month or whatever to have them fix your site speed. Nostra actually works, and it's like probably the best investment you can make in your CRO, not only because it increases site speed, but also because it, from a SEO perspective, increases your Google performance, which then allows you to rank higher on Google. Not a paid partner of Nostra, but it's one of those like pleasant surprises where I went in kind of thinking this is a site speed sham, and it turned out to be a really kind of straightforward app that improved my business.
Huge.
Yeah.
I like that. We've talked a lot about Twitter. I think everyone's got to go follow you on Twitter just because the way you're building in public and also peppering in cool things from Not Boring and Packy, just cool ideological intellectual things as well. But I recently came across your take on Twitter, and I think it was one of the best takes I've heard. I feel like it's the issue about Disney and a lot of these big brands, so-called woke brands or whatever, pulling budgets away from Twitter, and Elon making it this big free speech issue and making, you know, having this huge, this tirade, on stage the other day. What's your take on Twitter as an ad platform?
Yeah. I mean, I think Twitter as an ad platform or as a business is potentially different than like what Musk and a lot of other people view Twitter as. And I think those two things could be more symbiotic, right? Like, I think if Twitter had a better ads product and was less reliant on kind of brand marketing because like it doesn't have an ads product to support direct response marketing, it would be less at the whim of brand marketers, whether it's Disney or Apple or whoever. And so my take essentially was like X's business problem isn't that, all of these that Elon needs to kind of acquiesce to the wokeness of different brands. It's that they don't have an ad product that these brands don't have a choice in using. And using basically TikTok as an example, right? So TikTok, for all intents and purposes, is essentially operated by the CCP. I think it's fair to say that the CCP certainly has an influence on business and operation.
And total visibility into, at the very least, right? There's no.
Certainly. And at the very least, American brands, and they can do what they like, but investing heavily into TikTok is essentially an investment heavily into China, which better or worse on that front, right? But essentially, Disney, Apple, all these large brand marketers or marketers in general still advertise on TikTok. And it's not because they are more ideologically aligned with TikTok than they are with Elon Musk and Twitter. It's that TikTok has a good ads product, whether it's from a conversion perspective or a reach perspective. And so I'm not just saying you need to be like Meta in the sense that like you need to deliver predictable CPAs, but you need to be able to deliver something relatively predictably, whether it's conversions or reach. And so that's the threshold. Like TikTok's not even close to as good, and maybe you can debate this with me, I'm even close to as good at delivering those results as Meta. So the threshold for these brands is like, hey, we need something that's like decently performant relative to Meta, and we will look the other way on all ideological reasons because they're decently performant. Versus Twitter, because it's only brand marketing, because essentially what those companies are doing by even buying ads on Twitter in the first place is saying, hey, for what it's worth, we are literally just lighting this money on fire because we don't know where else to put this money in our marketing budgets. And like, sure, we'll try out Twitter. When Musk or X no longer ideologically align with those brand marketers, it's way easier for them to be like, hey, instead of burning this money on fire, we're just not going to burn this money on fire and go put it into another ad platform that at least has some level of performance. And because they're able to say that, they're like, they just have a lot more leverage over Musk. I think I was probably a little bit more eloquent in my stating of the argument on X, but essentially, I think a lot of the social angst that Musk is coming up against on Twitter is as a result of them not having a real ads product and their business basically being built on brands being generous with their ad dollars rather than needing to spend those ad dollars on the platform.
And having, that like that old school mind of like non-performance marketing, like, okay, well, there's a lot of people on Twitter, so we budget this money for Twitter. But, you know, the other stat that's flying around is like the amount of like small and medium business owners that make up Meta's ad spend. Like it's very decentralized, like because it's such an easy to use platform. You know, on your thread, there's people popping in there to be like, I know a guy that's using Twitter really well. And everyone knows a guy who's figured out how to do the right organic paid, you know, structure on Twitter. But as opposed to something like Meta, where like a lot of people can just pump in dollars and see benefits, you don't need to know some secret code. So you're going to obviously have a lot more base in that. And then when it comes to these big brand advertisers, like I couldn't believe when I first heard that there was like the amount of advertising dollars that were being pumped into Twitter that were being pulled out. I'm like, I feel like I never see ads on Twitter. It's something about the, like I'm there to, you know, digest CPC dialectics or whatever. Right. And so I've never seen, especially those big brand dollars. You just don't feel like it's even on that platform. So when I heard they were taking, I'm like, I didn't even think Mercedes was on this platform. And why would they when they could be just putting it into something that had such better performance metrics on these other platforms?
Versus when you're on Instagram, a brand that has way less ad spend than Mercedes on Twitter can feel like they're everywhere on Instagram. It's because the targeting is much better and more relevant than it is on Twitter, or X rather. It's literally a generous act for all of these brands to be investing ad dollars onto X. And so when they're less in the generous spirit because Musk has said something that's pissed them off or said something that they think they don't want to align with, they're going to be like, oh, that generous thing we've been doing by just kind of burning $1 billion of ad spend on your platform for no reason every month. We're just no longer going to do that. And it doesn't really hurt our business by us pulling those dollars.
Musk is just trying to hold on until X can become a banking platform. He just needs to hold on until he can get tied to our bank accounts, and for now, I am glad that there is a so-called free speech platform. But I couldn't imagine burning any ad revenue on it. Like I think we have tested a little bit for subscribers here and there, and we are not one of those players that have cracked how to do Twitter, so we won't be putting any budget there.
Yeah.
Well, you're in the interesting position of being on this podcast where I feel like our listener audience is probably also a great customer audience for you. I feel like a lot of people in our audience are self-optimizers. So go to trycreate.co. It's .co, right?
.co, yeah. Terrible domain, right? Got to figure it out.
It's funny. Ours is .co too. And I love .co's. And then I had a deep tech guy be like, I bet you Columbia never asked for their domains back. And I'm like, and I didn't realize it actually is the Colombian domain.
Is it? I did not know that.
Apparently, so you're selling the right kind of white powder. I'll leave it there. Thanks for coming on the DC podcast, man. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah, that actually just reminded me. Maybe our next product will be cocaine gummies. Didn't think about it, but yeah.
Actually, you opened the door. What are some of the other products that you're thinking about? Because I think that's the other really great benefit of the product you've created and the area that you're in is there's a huge amount of other ways you can kind of build out laterally.
Yeah. We'll be coming out with, I think the first thing is just a bunch of new flavors. We saw with the blue raspberry launch that flavor really expands the audience base a little bit and allows us to speak to new and existing customers in different ways. So I think that's the first thing, but I think really anything that you're taking on a daily basis that can be put into a gummy is within our purview. And so we'll leave that at what it is. But I think there's a big opportunity here to just make daily supplementation more convenient and a more enjoyable experience.
Nice. And probably not cocaine anytime until you're not going to go back to the Coke route, like the Coca-Cola in the 20s.
No, I won't be the opposite of that. Yeah. Nice.
Awesome, Dan. Thanks a lot, bud.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to today's episode. If you're not a subscriber to our newsletter, you can do that right now at directtoconsumer.co. I'm Eric Dick, and this has been the D2C Podcast. We'll see you next time.